King Saul offers for us some, I suppose, rather depressing information as we study from the Scriptures. We find that he is appointed, or when he is appointed to be king, his attitude is apparently very humble. We first see him identifying himself as a Benjamite, the smallest of the tribes, and he considers himself the least in his father's house. Later, when we see them looking for him, he is among the baggage. And then when the Philistines begin to present problems among the Israelites to engage in battle, we find that King Saul is behind the oxen in the field. He's working, he's plowing, as it were. And when he learns of the threat of the Ammonites, he's angry. He gathers together an army and proves himself to be quite a valiant leader, to the extent that those who have followed him see that there are those who have been critical of him, and they are ready to kill them. And Saul says there's not going to be any more killing today. But as we turn the page to the 13th chapter, we see that Samuel has instructed Saul that he is to remain in Gilgal, and he says, "I'll be there in 7 days and offer the burnt offering and entreat of the Lord regarding the engagement of the Philistines." And the text tells us that Samuel delayed. In other words, he wasn't there at the time that Saul anticipated him being there. Now, the picture that I gather of that is that Samuel said, "I'll be there in 7 days." Doesn't necessarily mean I'll be there at daybreak on the seventh day. But Saul, nonetheless, saw that Samuel had delayed and offered the burnt offering. And when Samuel came, right on the heels of him having done that, he asked Saul, "What hast thou done?" And Samuel is told by Saul, "I forced myself," there in verse 12, "to offer the burnt offering." And in verse 13, Samuel says, of chapter 13, "Thou hast done foolishly." Now we note that there were to be consequences that would ensue. Saul would no longer be privileged to look upon his house as the one that would be blessed with the descent of kings. The kingdom would be removed from his house. Verse 14. "And God would seek a man after his own heart," the text tells us. Now, in the context of these verses, you can clearly see why that Saul would be so distraught. His army has been whittled down to about 600 men, and the Philistines are described as the sand on the seashore for a multitude. And so he is very much distraught. And the Philistines have sent out armies in about 3 different directions. And Saul is very much perplexed. When we studied the 14th chapter, I believe a chapter sometimes that we just pass over in our studies of Saul, because the 14th chapter discusses in some detail Saul's son Jonathan and the courage and the confidence that Jonathan has. Jonathan realizes that God is not restrained by numbers. And even though our army is few and the Philistines are many, it does not mean that God cannot deliver the Philistines into our hand. And so Jonathan, with his armor bearer, an army of 2, engages the garrison of the Philistines and is very successful. At their first attack, they kill about 20 men of the Philistines, and the Israelites are encouraged. And those who have fled while Saul is delayed join the battle. They're encouraged, and Saul and his army now engage the Philistines. However, Saul, his attitude is, "Nobody eats until I be avenged of mine enemies." And that proved to be a very unwise tactic on behalf of Saul. Jonathan, indeed, he didn't get the memo. And he dipped his rod in honey and did eat and was strengthened. But the rest of Saul's army, who is charged not to eat, they do not eat. And what's happening with them? They're becoming weak. In fact, in verse 31, it tells us the people were very faint, and it was found out that Jonathan had indeed eaten of the honey. And what is it that Saul is ready to do to his own son? He's ready to kill him as a consequence of having disobeyed him. But the people say, no, there are not going to be any killing today. We're not going to kill Jonathan. And so Jonathan was delivered, as it were. Now in verse 47, through most of the verses following, we see the great victories that King Saul had. He was victorious over Moab, the Ammonites, the Edomites, the kings of Zobah, and against the Philistines. And in verse 48, he smote the Amalekites. In verse 52 of chapter 14, it tells us there was sore war against the Philistines all the days of Saul. And when Saul saw any mighty man or any valiant man, he took him unto him. Now that's exactly what Samuel said that kings will do. They'll take your sons and your daughters, and they will force them into their service and into the service of their soldiers. And so it was that Saul drafted men into his army as he saw anyone that seemed to be a valiant man. Now in the 15th chapter, as we discussed in our study Wednesday night, we noted that Saul is instructed to go and smite Amalek and to utterly destroy the Amalekites. Look at your Bible there in 1 Samuel chapter 15. In verse 3, go and smite Amalek and utterly destroy all that they have and spare them not, but slay both man and woman, infant and suckling, ox and sheep, camel and ass. Anything ambiguous about the instructions of God to Saul? Anybody in the class this morning that has a problem understanding what Saul was instructed to do? Everybody's clear on that? All right. Randy's got a problem with that.
No, I don't have a
problem. Oh, okay.
just noted up in chapter 14, verse 48, talk about Saul. He acted valiantly and defeated the Amalekites.
All right.
So that was, we're to understand, that was a battle.
That was a battle, yes. What he's instructed to do is to destroy them. Now, obviously, he does not do that. And later, we see more battles with the Amalekites because he doesn't do this. And we'll talk about that. But you're right. This was a battle. He had engaged them, and he had defeated them, and he had run them back, but not destroyed them. So now God instructs him to utterly destroy them. But he doesn't do that. As we studied, he brings back the best of the Amalekites, brought back the king of the Amalekites. And then when Samuel approaches him about what he did, he said, I have performed the commandment of the Lord. Verse 11, you see that. Well, no, that's not what you did, King Saul. If you did that, I would not hear the lowing of the oxen and the bleating of the sheep. Someone has said that these animals are calling Saul a liar, and that's right. He did not do what God said. In verse 13, once again, he affirms, I have performed the commandment of the Lord. And in verse 15, how does he explain, then, the sound of the animals?
The people.
They wanted to bring back the best of the Amalekites and to offer them as a sacrifice, and the rest we have utterly destroyed. That distinction between they and we is impressive. I want you to see that, how that we often try to separate ourselves from the wrong that has been done and affirm our loyalty or our faithfulness to the commandments of God. And Saul was in charge. He was king. He had disobeyed the Lord. And of course, we note that Samuel reminds him that when you were little in your father's house, you were anointed to be king. And now look at what you've done. And you have disobeyed the voice of God. And Saul, again in verse 20, says, yea, I have obeyed the voice of Jehovah, and have gone the way which Jehovah sent me, and have brought Agag, the king of Amalek, and have utterly destroyed the Amalekites, but the people took of the spoil, sheep and oxen, and the chief of the devoted things to sacrifice unto Jehovah thy God in Gilgal. Now we've noted the distinction here as Saul has said a couple of times, thy God. And I think that's something we want to make note of. Saul is in disobedience to God.
Just to point that out again, when Jonathan and his armor bearer have that victory, Saul claims that is his victory. But here, when something's wrong, he's going to push that off on the people.
Typical, isn't it?
Well, yeah.
When things are going well, we did that. But when things are not going well, they did that. Bruce?
You know, just like when he disobeyed God, before, wait for Samuel to come, and Samuel will bless. But now, here again, he's blaming all the people.
Mm-hmm.
They've taken the best of everything, and now we're going to offer sacrifices to the Lord.
Yeah.
And again, he displayed himself another time.
Well, that's right. He's not doing what God said, obviously, and we know that. But, Randy?
I just know this is a prime example of the difference between David and Saul. When Nathan came to David, pointed out that he was in sin with Bathsheba, David's reaction was, I've sinned against the Lord. He humbled himself and said, I've sinned. And here, Samuel comes and shows the sin that Saul done, and Saul argues with him and says in verse 20, I did obey the voice of the Lord.
Yeah.
He's not going to accept what he's done at all. He's an argument point.
Sometimes we have to be showed, and when Samuel makes it very clear that you have disobeyed God, finally, as he says that what you have done is rebellion against God, and that you have rejected the word of God, verse 23, and that you've displayed stubbornness. So we see the rebuke of Samuel. And then finally, in verse 24, Saul said unto Samuel, I have sinned, for I have transgressed the commandment of Jehovah and thy words, because I feared the people and obeyed their voice. Now again, he calls upon Samuel that he might receive pardon of the Lord, and that he might worship the Lord. But in verse 26, Samuel said to Saul, I will not return with thee, for thou hast rejected the word of Jehovah, and Jehovah hath rejected thee from being king over Israel. Finally, we see that Samuel does return with Saul, and we talked about that in order to save face. Saul desires that Samuel go with him. Bruce?
You know, verse 23, King James puts another word in there for rebellion, is as sin, witchcraft.
Yep.
And stubbornness.
Right, right. You've rebelled, and that's like witchcraft, and stubbornness is like idolatry and terrorism. You know, sometimes we have to draw a picture, much like Nathan did with David and the rich man and the poor man, the little ewe lamb that was killed for the rich man's guest. Sometimes we can see it only if a picture is drawn, but Saul is reluctant to see that. But I want to call your attention as we study through this, and we've read this in our study last Wednesday, but God has taken the kingdom from Saul and given it to thy neighbor, verse 28, that is better than thou. Now that's got to be received as a slap. There's somebody better than me? When you're talking to somebody that's arrogant, and the light bulb finally comes on that I'm not the top dog on the ladder, you see. There's somebody that's better than me. That's got to be humbling. And yet, however, we see that Saul continues to plummet and make mistake after mistake after mistake. And we want to talk about that as our study progresses this morning. But we note that Samuel killed Agag, who had an arrogant disposition. Look at your Bible, if you will. Those of you who were not here Wednesday in particular, notice in verse 32, it said, "Then said Samuel, bring ye hither to me Agag, the king of the Amalekites. And Agag came unto him cheerfully. And Agag said, surely the bitterness of death is past." Get the picture there. That's almost laughable if it wasn't so serious. Here's the king of the Amalekites, the enemy of God's people, and God has specifically instructed Saul to kill this man and to destroy everything that they have, and Saul has brought back King Agag, and now we see the exchange between Samuel and Saul, and Saul is in trouble for not having killed Agag and not having destroyed all of the Amalekites, and now the haughtiness of Agag to appear before Samuel and say, "Well, I guess there's not going to be any more killing today," and be cheerful about that, as if I've survived, everything's great with me.
One thing that I wanted to point out is I have a footnote here that next to cheerfully that says, "or haltingly," the Hebrew is uncertain.
Ah.
So we don't really know whether it's the cheerfully or the haltingly. The rest of the context seems like the cheerfully would make more sense.
It does.
There's some uncertainty.
Yeah.
Well, but, you know, I wouldn't get the impression from this that Agag is being haughty at all. I'm just getting the impression that he's being brought before another person who he knows is a priest, and he knows that priest is going to be merciful to him and will allow him to live.
Oh, he anticipates that. Surely the bitterness of death is past. Well, what's happening now?
He sees his Savior standing in front of him.
He thinks.
But his Savior's got a sword.
But his Savior has a sword, yeah. Yeah. Well, I don't know. I kind of come away with the idea of arrogance on Agag's behalf, because it appears he thinks that he has circumvented somehow what Saul was instructed to do, and that's not going to happen. Yes. Okay. Well, now that's a good word, because indeed he needs to be cautious.
Yep.
Yeah. Randy?
It's my different version of different marginal notes. Mine says next to cheerfully, or in bonds.
Or?
In bonds.
In bonds?
Yeah.
Well, those are not even close to the same idea. That's interesting.
I mean, he was a prisoner, so it's...
Well, yeah, he was. He was indeed, I'm sure, in bonds, but the idea is he thinks he's going to circumvent what God said was to happen to him. And that's not going to happen. And Samuel took his sword and cut him up in pieces. And so it was that King Agag was destroyed. Now, we've talked about things that are on this chart, except just one or two things. No, we've talked about all that. But I do want to talk with you about the last statement in this chapter. In verse 35, it says, "And Samuel came no more to see Saul until the day of his death, for Samuel mourned for Saul. And Jehovah repented that he had made Saul king over Israel." Saul has changed. He's not the same fellow that he was. And sometimes we change. Sometimes a few successes kind of flames our ego a little bit. And that's what happened with King Saul. And he's changed. I want you to note one thing about Samuel at this point. The text tells us that Samuel mourned for Saul. Yet we note that it was Samuel who rebuked Saul. Samuel knew what Saul did. God had told him. But yet he went to Saul anyway and rebuked him. And it tells us the attitude that Samuel had towards Saul. It's not one of anger, necessarily. Perhaps disappointment might characterize it quite well. But he mourned for Saul. Why would he do that? Because of his disobedience. Let me ask you, would our mourning for someone who has engaged in sin be motivation to go and talk with that person about their sin? I fear sometimes we miss that, brethren. We look at Samuel and we say, well, he served in the priestly capacity and God was communicating with him and all of it, as if that was his job, and maybe so. But it wasn't his job to become emotional about what Saul did. He's not being paid to be emotional. That's genuine. What we see is Samuel is deeply grieved because of the sin that Saul has committed. And if that's not a motivation to go and talk to Saul, I don't know what is. But Saul has displayed an arrogance about it that causes him to continue to plummet. And Samuel sees Saul no more. Do you note that? You think Samuel knows what's happened to Saul? Indeed. Now, as you continue in the 16th chapter, we see that God had already instructed Samuel there's going to be somebody else to be king, a man after God's own heart. We've already read that in chapter 16. I'm sorry, in chapter 13, there about verse 14. A man after God's own heart. We see on the passages that are on the screen, familiar text to you, that Saul, or that David was characterized by the humility that seemingly has departed from King Saul. Now, something in the 16th chapter that I find especially interesting, number one, the question that God asked Samuel, how long wilt thou mourn for Saul, seeing I have rejected him from being king over Israel? Is that a good question? How long will you mourn over Saul? Judgment's already been passed on Saul. Saul's not going to change. That's just the way that that is.
Perspective is a little bit clearer in verse 2.
All right.
It's not just mourning. It's realizing that the current state of affairs is Saul's not a happy man.
No.
I've just told him that the kingdom's going to be taken from him. And if I'm the one who's going to take it from him, he's going to want to kill me. He's got fear.
All right.
Fear and grief together.
All right. All right. But there's work for Samuel to do. And I've used frequently the word paralyzed. This is not a time for Samuel to be paralyzed. There's things that he needs to do and overcome these emotions in order to carry out the work that God has for him to do. Now, what is it that Samuel is to do? We've talked about Elijah in the sermon last Sunday night. How that Elijah wanted to go and hide and hid himself in a cave. And God asked him, what doest thou here? Well, there's a time to kind of pull ourselves up by the bootstraps, and we've got to go forward. And that time has come for Samuel to move forward. There's work to be done. And his work now is to anoint David to be the king over Israel. You see, the king's business has to go on. And Samuel has to realize that. In chapter 6, in the next following verses, we find that that Samuel arrives at the house of whom? Jesse the Bethlehemite. And Jesse the Bethlehemite has a number of sons. Yes. Chapter 16, yes. And he sees Eliab, verse 6. Eliab is not the one to be appointed. Abinadab in verse 8. But Abinadab is not the one that God has selected. Shema in verse 9, but he is not the one. And the question then is asked, is this all of your children? And the answer to that is no. There's one younger brother that you've not met yet, and his name is David. And so he is sent for, and we see him described in verse 12. He's brought in, and he's described as ruddy, with all a beautiful countenance and goodly to look upon. And Jehovah said, arise, anoint him, for this is he. And the Spirit of Jehovah, verse 13, came mightily upon David from that day forward. And Samuel rose up and went to Ramah. Now, as the Spirit of the Lord is mighty upon David, what's happened to Saul? The Spirit has departed from Saul. And you'll notice, and I don't understand all I know about this in verse 14. You might have some insight into that. It tells us that an evil spirit from Jehovah troubled him. And that's not the only time we see that. An evil spirit from Jehovah troubled him. What does that suggest to us without an elaborate explanation? What does that suggest to us is wrong with Saul? Essentially, that's so. Yes, God has given him up to do what he is going to do. But what effect has that had really upon Saul? Saul's been told, there's somebody better than you. The kingdom is not going to continue with you.
He's downplayed.
Well, he's not only downplayed it, but let's just say he's down. He's just down. And you can see why. So much has been taken from him, and it's his sole responsibility that it has been taken from him. He's messed up. And as the thought continues in verse 16, again we note that when this evil spirit from God comes upon you, what then is suggested that Saul do? Hire a musician. Well, we understand that music can be comforting at times. And so, who is to play for Saul so that he can be comforted when he's troubled? Young David. I find it interesting that the relationship at first between David and Saul appears to be somewhat close. You'll note in verse 21, it says, "And David came to Saul and stood before him, and he loved him greatly, and he became his armor bearer. And Saul sent to Jesse, saying, Let David, I pray thee, stand before me, for he hath found favor in my sight. And it came to pass, when the evil spirit from Jehovah, or from God, was upon Saul, that David took the harp and played with his hand. So Saul was refreshed and was well, and the evil spirit departed from him." You would look at that and say, well, David and Saul make a pretty good team. Because of David's musical abilities, Saul is now able to function. Don't continue that way, does it? Saul is still in the position of being king, but he's no longer the one upon whom God's Spirit abides. And the Philistines, they're still there, aren't they? They just continue to be a problem. The Philistines. And as we think about the Philistines in the 17th chapter, they once again come to do battle. And you'll look on this map and you'll see where they're encamped. And again, here is Gibeah, the supposed capital of King Saul. And we know that Saul had been camped down here in Gilgal quite a bit during his time as king. But look at how close the Philistines are coming to the capital of the kingdom of Saul. Now, being encamped there, Saul's army now is encamped here. And we might look at that and say, well, strategically, you've got a valley running between them. Here's the higher elevation. And the battle is going to take place along here somewhere. Philistines on one side of the valley and the Israelites on the other side of the valley. But we have the Philistines with a threat. And their threat is, why don't you bring one of your most valiant men and fight against our champion? And if you win, we'll be your servants. If we win, you'll be our servants. Sounds like a sporting proposition, doesn't it, for a battle? That way everybody don't have to get all killed and everything. You see. You don't have to wake up dead. Yeah. Well, we've got a problem with that, you see. In verse 4, it says, chapter 17, "There went out a champion out of the camp of the Philistines, named Goliath of Gath, whose height was 6 cubits and a span." Well, that's about 9.5 feet tall, about 9 feet 9 inches, generally speaking. That's a pretty sizable fellow, isn't it? And we're not talking about just tall. When you put that kind of height on a fellow, you've got a big man. And when you continue reading in the text, it tells us in verse 5 that he had a helmet of brass upon his head, and he was clad with a coat of mail, and the weight of the coat was 5,000 shekels of brass. Some scholars tell us that that was in the neighborhood of 125 pounds. And in verse 6, he had gleaves of brass upon his legs. Now, who can tell me what a gleave is? Shin guards, basically. Some of them, I saw some pictures, they come up even up above the knee to present armor for the knee itself, but made out of brass. You think those were somewhat heavy? One for each leg? Yeah, he's carrying a lot of weight. And then if you'll note in verse 6, he had a javelin of brass between his shoulders and a staff. The staff of his spear was like a weaver's beam. And his spear's head weighed 600 shekels of iron. Again, one scholar in particular said that's about 15 pounds. And a shield bearer went before him. Now, I'll just tell you, I would be intimidated by the man's armor. I'd be intimidated by the man if he had no armor. But to think that I had to engage a man of that size with all that armor who had somebody else along to carry his shield, that would be somewhat intimidating, wouldn't it to you? It was to the whole of the army of Saul. All of Saul's army. Yeah, they were paralyzed with fear. Now, if you'll notice in the text, it tells us in verse 8, he stood and cried unto the armies of Israel and said unto them, why are you come out to set your battle in array? Am not I, a Philistine, and ye servants to Saul? Choose you a man of you, and let him come down to me. If he be able to fight with me and kill me, then will we be your servants. But if I prevail against him and kill him, then shall ye be our servants. And the Philistine said, I defy the armies of Israel this day. Give me a man that we may fight together. And when Saul and all Israel heard those words of the Philistine, they were dismayed and greatly afraid. How long did that go on? Pardon me? For how long? Look at verse 16.
40 days.
Every day he'd come out and defy the army of Israel. For 40 days. That'd get a little discouraging, wouldn't it? You see, this is going nowhere. They're on their hill and we're on our hill and the valley's in between and we're scared to death. Now, Jesse said unto David to go down there and see how things are. And when David went down there to see how things are, this is what he saw. And he hears that the king will enrich with great riches the man who will fight Goliath. And he'll give his daughter to the man who will fight Goliath. And he will make his father's house free in Israel. The man who will fight Goliath. Anything else you want to go fight Goliath there, Randy? Just set the price. That's kind of the attitude that we see. Somebody, go fight Goliath. But you see, there aren't any takers. And David spake, look at verse 26, to the men that stood by him, saying, what shall be done to the man that killeth this Philistine and taketh away the reproach for Israel? For who is this uncircumcised Philistine that he should defy the armies of the living God? And the people answered him after the manner, saying, so shall it be done to the man that killeth him. Well, the king's going to bestow all these favors on the man that kills the Philistine. Well, who is this uncircumcised Philistine? Now, I want to call your attention kind of off our track just a little bit here to David's expression of uncircumcised. You see how that word is used. Now, I want you to have that thought in mind when you read that over in the New Testament. When you read about the Gentiles identified as uncircumcised, how is that word used? It's a word used in derision to describe those who are enemies of God. Do you see that? It's not a word used very proudly. It's an ugly word. These uncircumcised Philistines. Who does he think he is? And this is the word that then is used by the Jews to describe the Gentiles. Tells you what the Gentiles were thought of, doesn't it, by the Jews? But as you continue in verse 28, Eliab, his eldest brother, heard when he spake unto the men, and Eliab's anger was kindled against David. What is David now being accused of? You young whippersnapper, what are you doing down here? You've just come to see. I know your pride, I know your naughtiness, and you're come down just to see what's going on. You see, his motives are called in question. Now, David has been sent by his father to see what's going on.
But he's not a soldier, and the other guys are soldiers, and they're coming in funny. Yeah.
They are indeed, yes. But look at David in verse 31. And when the words were heard which David spake, they rehearsed them before Saul, and he sent for him. And David said to Saul, now remember that David and Saul, they know who each other are. They know each other. And he sent for him. And he said, let no man's heart fail because of him. Thy servant will go and fight with this Philistine. I'll go fight him. Now you don't see arrogance on behalf of David. That's not the thought at all. Read on, verse 33. And Saul said to David, thou art not able to go against this Philistine to fight with him, for thou art but a youth. And he is a man of war from his youth. Observe just here, young people, that God can use young people, can't he? You're just a youth. This man is, he's mature. He's been fighting since he was a boy. And you'll note in verse 34, David said unto Saul, thy servant was keeping his father's sheep, and when there came a lion or a bear and took a lamb out of the flock, I went out after him and smote him and delivered it out of his mouth. And when he arose against me, I caught him by the beard and smote him and slew him. Thy servant smote both the lion and the bear, and this uncircumcised Philistine shall be as one of them, seeing he hath defied the armies of the living God. And David said, look at your Bible now. Jehovah that delivered me out of the paw of the lion and out of the paw of the bear will deliver me out of the hand of this Philistine. Now, when David said, the bear and the Philistine attacked my lambs, and I killed them, who gets the credit for it?
The bear and the Philistine.
The bear and the Philistine. Well, eventually that's so, but that's not where I am just yet. The bear and the lion. Who gets the credit for it?
God.
God does. Who had delivered David? God did. Out of the hand of the bear and out of the paw of the bear and out of the paw of the lion. You're determined to mess me up all that. All right. And so Saul said to David, go and Jehovah be with thee. And Saul clad David with his apparel and put on a helmet of brass on his head and clad him with a coat of mail. And David girded his sword upon his apparel and said to go, for he had not proved it. And David said unto Saul, I cannot go with these, for I have not proved them. And David put them off him. Now I want to ask you a question. What does he mean when he says, I have not proved them? I can't use these.
He's
not a soldier. I'm not a soldier. Well, what was David?
Shepherd.
He was a shepherd. That's right. And he was not a warrior. He didn't use a sword, didn't know how to carry a shield and all these armaments. He was unfamiliar with them. Now, lots of lessons involved in that. We've just talked about from the Ephesian letter, chapter 6, putting on the armor of God. And as we put on the armor of God, it's to be used. But what does that demand if we're going to be successful in its use? You learn how to use it. You learn how to use it. Now, the best time to learn how to use it is not necessarily the first time that you have to use it. All right? So that's why we have Bible classes and such things and consider things such as that. But anyway, it says in verse 40, and he took his staff in his hand and chose him 5 smooth stones out of the brook and put them into the shepherd's bag, which he had even in his wallet, and his sling was in his hand, and he drew near to the Philistine. Now, one of these days, I'm going to make a slingshot like what I understand David had. I've made many of them, the kind that you sling like this. Some of you who are older have made those. Maybe you sling it like this. but you understand what that will do. And if you've ever made one, if you've ever slung one, you know that a stone will come out of that as fast as a bullet. I mean, it goes really fast. And it can be exceedingly dangerous. And if you get to be real good with that, it's a very, very powerful weapon. And so David used his slingshot and five smooth stones out of the brook. Now, you saw on our map a while ago, it was the brook that was separating these two armies. And so David approaches the Philistine. And in verse 42, it says, "And when the Philistine looked about and saw David, he disdained him, for he was but a youth, and ruddy, and with all of a fair countenance." Now,
ruddy.
Ruddy. All right.
Ruddy's a name.
Okay. The point of contrast is, here you have this young fellow that is fair complected, who is carrying five stones and a slingshot, against a man that's pretty burly, not a youth, who has weapons of war, and he's 9.5 feet tall. And the Philistine makes fun of him. And the point is, in verse 44, "The Philistine said unto David, Come unto me, and I will give thy flesh to the birds of the heavens, and to the beasts of the field. Then said David to the Philistine, Thou comest to me with a sword, and with a spear, and with a javelin, but I come to thee in the name of Jehovah of hosts, the God of the Israel, or the God of the armies of Israel, whom thou hast defied. This day will Jehovah deliver thee into my hand, and I will smite thee, and take thy head from off thee, and I will give the dead bodies of the host of the Philistines this day unto the birds of the heavens, and to the wild beasts of the earth, that all the earth may know that there is a God in Israel, and that all this assembly may know that Jehovah saveth not with sword or and spear, for the battle is Jehovah's, and he will give you into our hand." Bruce? Yeah.
When I was a young little boy, okay, there's two types of slingshots.
Mm-hmm.
And the one that you talked about right now is really hard to aim.
Yep.
And not only hard to aim, but you got to let it go at the right time.
That is true.
I'm going to be the wings.
Yes, sir. Yes, sir.
So the other slingshot, you can take it and pull it back, and you can, you can definitely be on target.
You can be on target, but it's not nearly as powerful. We used to use green walnuts in ours. Oh, you could throw a green walnut a long, long way. And throw it hard, yes. That's the difference. Yeah, it would be a lethal weapon in the hand of somebody that knew how to use it. Exactly right. Well, as we read in this text, David's confidence is in God, not necessarily any slingshot or his own ability. But his confidence is in God to deliver the Israelites from the hands of the Philistines. And of course, you're familiar with the text, verse 49. David put his hand in the bag and took thence a stone and slung it and smote the Philistine in his forehead. And the stone sank into his forehead and he fell upon his face. And David prevailed over the Philistine with a sling with a stone and smote the Philistine and slew him. But there was no sword in the hand of David. So what did David do to provide himself with a sword? He took Goliath's sword. Can you imagine the size of that thing? He took Goliath's sword. What did he do with it? He cut his head off. And so the snake is dead. And David has proven himself to be victor. He takes the armor of the Philistine Goliath and put it in his tent. And Saul then wants to talk about who David is. Who is this? Now, go ahead.
One who God has chosen.
That is right. That's right. And David explains in verse 58 that I am the son of thy servant Jesse, the Bethlehemite. David. Well, we've talked about that. This is where the battle took place. Yes.
It's worthy of note that the Philistines didn't fall through on their promise, which was to your servants. Whoever wins this battle will be your servants, you'll be our servants.
That's right. Well, what did the children of Israel do with the Philistines?
They chased them.
Yes. Well, I wouldn't be so inclined to be a servant either for a crowd of folks that killed my champion, and now they're chasing me. So the Philistines run away, but this is not the end of the Philistines. We continue to have problems with the Philistines. But as we come to the 18th chapter, we see that the relationship between Saul and David begins to be more than just a little bit strained. In verse 1 of chapter 18, we've already been introduced to Saul's son, Jonathan, and how that Jonathan has confidence in God, and how that he engaged the Philistine garrison and really called upon the Israelite army to be united in their fight against the Philistines. But what we see here is that Jonathan and David become the very best of friends. The very best of friends. Now, the irony of that is Saul and David, from Saul's perspective, become the bitterest of enemies. And as the text continues in the 18th chapter, David and Jonathan make a covenant between them. Sometimes it's necessary to do that, I suppose. When we have one that becomes an ally of the enemy of another, we make a covenant between ourselves that we're not going to let this upset the apple cart with us. And so Saul, though he became the enemy of David through Saul's intent, David and Jonathan made a covenant that we're going to be friends, and they were. Very close friends. But as the thing continues in the 18th chapter, look at David's behavior. Verse 5, David went out whithersoever Saul sent him and behaved himself wisely. The things that David engages in are productive. He uses sound judgment in his decisions, and his reputation begins to flourish. In verse 7, the women sang to one another as they played, "Saul has slain his thousands, and David his 10,000s." Now, what's Saul already heard about David? He's better than you are. He's already seen that displayed. Because while Saul is sitting over here trembling and would not fight the Philistines, David did and killed Goliath.
Saul didn't know at this point that David had been
anointed.
No. So he knows that somebody's been chosen who's better than him, but he doesn't know that that's David.
That is probably correct. Yeah.
He'll know it soon enough.
But he knows somebody's better than he is. And now he hears the women singing that David's better than you are. You've killed thousands. David's killed his 10,000. Like I said, he's seen that displayed. Surely he would come to the conclusion in his own mind, why didn't he go fight Goliath? Oh, yes.
That's better than him because Saul eyed him from that day forward.
That's right. That's right. And interestingly enough, in verse 10, this evil spirit came upon him. And what did he do? David's playing over here trying to comfort him. And what does Saul do?
He tries
to nail him to the wall. Yeah, with his spear. That's right. Didn't seem to help. No, didn't seem to help. And that's the second buzzer. Okay. I want you to continue reading here in chapter 18. Read on through the relationship of David and Saul till you come to the time of Saul's death. Okay? We'll try to talk about that some more next time.